Hello, I am Sergio Giralt, the Melvin Berlin Family Chair in Myeloma Research, Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and the Chief Attending of the Adult BMT Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Today, I want to spend some time talking to you about the landscape of acute myeloid leukemia therapy with hematopoietic cell transplantation in the era of novel agents. During this presentation, I will cover the role of transplant in light of the new agents that are now available, which patients should be considered for stem cell transplant, barriers and challenges that confront patients and their families and the transplant programs to get into a hematopoietic cell transplantation, and what transplants can do for patients that standard therapy cannot. What I'm showing you here are the NCCN guidelines, the version of 2020. These are for patients less than 60 years of age and over 18. As you can see, and as we all know, treatment depends on the presence or absence of specific cytogenetic abnormalities. Core binding factor abnormalities should get high-dose therapy. Intermediate risk cytogenetics and/or molecular abnormalities should be induced with high-dose RSC and considered for allogeneic transplant. And then, in other patients with unfavorable cytogenetics, again, high-dose RSC induction and consideration for an allogeneic transplant should be had. Now, we need to remember that in 2018, there were five drugs that were FDA-approved for acute myelogenous leukemia. Midostaurin is a FLT3 inhibitor, and it was approved for newly diagnosed AML with FLT3 mutations. CPX351, trade name Vixius, or liposomal doxorubicin RSC, was approved for therapy-related AML or AML with MDS changes. Gemtuzumab osigomycin, or Mylotarg, was approved for CD33 AML. And nasatinib was approved for IDH2 relapse refractory acute myelogenous leukemia. Furthermore, ivosidenib was approved for IDH1 mutated relapse refractory acute myelogenous leukemia. Towards the end of 2018, we had three more approvals: glastegib, venetoclax, gilteritinib, and for blastic plasmacytoid dendritic cell neoplasm, tagrogavcin. So, how do we incorporate these new agents into our treatment paradigms? So now, the landscape for AML induction has become much more complicated. For example, CD33-positive acute leukemias, which are usually good and intermediate risk, can be considered for gemtuzumab therapy. Patients with FLT3 mutations should be considered for midostaurin induction, with or without a 7+3 backbone. Patients with IDH mutations who are unfit could go into remission with a hypomethylating agent and venetoclax. And all others, if they are unfit, should be considered for a hypomethylating agent of venetoclax or glastegib if they have the appropriate cytogenetic abnormality. So what does the data look like when we do not use conventional induction? Well, the randomized trial of azacitidine versus conventional care for patients with AML greater than 30% blasts showed a significant benefit for azacitidine in regards to one-year survival, 46% versus 34%. And more and more physicians are actually using an azacitidine backbone as induction therapy for acute myelogenous leukemia to avoid the toxicities of conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy. So, in this case, we're now having a much more complicated NCCN guidelines. And I'm not going to go over them individually. You'll have the slide in the NCCN guidelines. But suffice it is to say that when initially there was only one size fits all, everybody got 7+3, now the combination of venetoclax and hypomethylating agents, either decitabine, azacitidine, or low-dose cytarabine, is being frequently used for patients who are both fit and unfit for allogeneic transplant. And patients who have a specific targetable abnormality, such as FLT3 mutated, standard dose cytarabine RSC in combination with midostaurin is considered the standard of care. For patients with IDH mutations, their use in induction therapy is currently being explored, and we'll discuss those studies in a minute. So, why are we so interested in non-cytotoxic induction therapies? This paper, presented in the 2018 ASH meeting by Dr. Dan Polia and his group and Courtney DiNardo, shows us the responses in patients who were ineligible for intensive therapy. What you can see is a very high rate of complete remissions and complete remissions with incomplete count recovery when we add venetoclax to either hypomethylating agent, be it azacitidine or decitabine. And early deaths were extremely low, 2% to 7%, significantly less than what would be expected with conventional chemotherapy, and the results significantly better than with supportive care alone. More importantly, in all genetic subgroups and in all AML types, the benefits, we saw high rates of CR and CRI. This would not have been seen, obviously, with supportive care alone, and the toxicity seen in these group of patients with a conventional 7+3 would have been extremely high. So overall survival for these patients is now almost a year and a half. Again, significantly better than what would be expected with either supportive care alone or conventional 7+3. So this has resulted in the adoption of a combination of venetoclax and hypomethylating agents for many patients who are 75 years or older who have comorbidities that preclude the use of intensive induction chemotherapy. However, many physicians are actually applying this combination to patients who could be eligible for intensive induction therapy or are using it as a bridge to transplant in the perception that patients will be coming into transplant in better condition. So, does this work for everyone? Many of the responses are complete remissions with incomplete counts recovery. We do know that mutations in PTPN11 increase resistance to venetoclax and azacitidine. In a retrospective study done by the City of Hope, patients with high-risk cytogenetics had a lower response rate, but patients who lacked the mutations in RAS, P53, and RUNX1 had better responses. IDH mutations have now been discovered as a major driver of acute myelogenous leukemia. This mutation causes metabolic dysregulation and epigenetic changes that impair cellular differentiation and results in an acute myeloid leukemia phenotype. Mutations of IDH1 and IDH2 are seen in approximately 15 to 20% of the patients. There are now two commercially available inhibitors of both of these mutations. Enasidenib is an inhibitor of IDH2, and ivosidenib is an inhibitor of IDH1. This again shows how complicated the landscape has become, because now we really should have mutational analysis done on all patients prior to start induction therapy, because patients with a FLT3 mutation should get midostaurin, and patients with an IDH mutation should be thought for an IDH inhibitor with 7+3. If they're fit, they should be considered for 7+3 and gemtuzumab or zygomycin. Many other FLT3 inhibitors are currently being explored: quizartinib, crenolib, and gilteritinib. Gilteritinib has also now been approved for patients with FLT3 mutated relapse refractory acute myelogenous leukemia. So does this mean we should revisit our current guidelines? Does this mean that patients with intermediate risk cytogenetics or treatment-related disease should not be considered for an allogeneic transplant if one is available? Well, let's do some reality checks. First, let's remember that a patient who's age 65 had a life expectancy of more than 80. That more and more patients over the age of 70 with both MDS and acute myelogenous leukemia are undergoing allogeneic transplants with reduced intensity conditioning regimens. And that it's not the age, but it's not how old you are, but how you carry your age that determines whether a patient is transplant eligible or not. Gait speed is an important assessment, that the slower the gait speed, the higher the mortality rate for patients. We now consider, and others have shown, as we have, that a formal geriatric assessment is essential to be able to decide what the risk-benefit ratio is for a patient to undergo an allogeneic transplant for acute myelogenous leukemia with intermediate or high-risk disease. This was analysis that was done by Dr. Soro and presented at the ASH meeting in 2018. What he looked was at the outcomes of patients who were being induced with acute myelogenous leukemia over various centers that participate in the Seattle Consortium. When we just looked at actual survival rates, patients with AML who underwent the transplant seemed to have a significantly better outcome than patients who did not undergo a transplant. But when you adjust for a variety of cofactors such as comorbidity scores and frailty scores, that difference actually disappears, suggesting that for specific patients, particularly those with good performance status, there may not be that much of a benefit for an allogeneic transplant. However, that was a retrospective study, and it was not randomized, and we do not know why patients received or did not receive a transplant. More important is this study from Brun et al. That was also presented at ASH 2018. This was a prospective multi-center study in AML in patients over the age of 50 who had achieved a complete remission who at least had one potential sibling donor. Approximately 77 patients had a sibling donor and underwent an allogeneic transplant, and they had 68 controls, and the baseline characteristics were similar. Overall survival of 3 years was similar for patients who underwent a transplant versus those that did not. Non-relapse mortality was also no different. However, at the tail of the curve, one starts seeing a significant benefit for an allogeneic transplant. The group in Germany, led by Dr. Nicholas Kroger, reported also in ASH of 2018 the prospective multicenter phase 3 study comparing azacitidine induction followed by stem cell transplant versus continued azacitidine according to donor availability in myelodysplastic patients between the age of 55 and 70. This is the CONSORT diagram. Suffice it is to say that patients who were eligible for transplant, most of them went on to proceed to transplant. When we look at results according to treatment arm, most of these patients received an unrelated donor transplant. Event-free survival at 3 years was significantly better for patients who underwent transplant. Survival was significantly better, although treatment-related mortality was also worse for the allogeneic transplant group. And this is the survival and the event-free survival curve. So what do older patients die of when they undergo transplant? They still die primarily from relapse and infections and graft versus host disease. How can we optimize outcomes? The group at the University of Chicago has done a significant work in trying to optimize the situation of patients prior to transplant with a comprehensive multidisciplinary approach in which all patients are seen by the geriatricians, the physiatrists, and social workers. So, interestingly enough, one of the things that is starting to emerge is that patients with low-intensity induction chemotherapy, many of them are proceeding to transplant. And, you know, in some studies, such as Khadia et al., 23% of the patients went on to transplant, even if they achieved a complete remission to a hypomethylating agent venetoclax combination. In Dr. DiNardo's series, 21% of the patients went on to transplant. When asked the question, would it be better for older patients who are going to be bridged to transplant to receive a hypomethylating agent versus to receive the standard 7+3? And at least in a preliminary look at our data at Memorial Sloan Kettering, patients who went to transplant after having received the low-intensity induction had a very low early non-relapse mortality, and the preliminary results suggest a very positive outcome with 60% of the patients surviving disease-free. How can we continue to improve outcomes? Well, we should find earlier referrals, better graft source and donor selection, and today everybody has a donor. We should think about new conditioning regimens and post-transplant therapies to prevent relapse. One of the areas that we're exploring here and others is optimization of chemotherapy by doing PK-directed therapy. In this paper by Bartolink et al., you can see what happens when we have an optimal exposure of busulfan, where the event-free survival is almost 80%. Overdosing busulfan increases transplant-related mortality. Underdosing busulfan results in disease relapse or graft failure. Unfortunately, busulfan is the only drug that we currently use in transplant that we have a mechanism to dose target. Another commonly used drug, such as antithymocyte globulin, also has an optimal dose. In this study done by Dr. Scordo and Dr. Bolins at Memorial Sloan Kettering, you can see what happens when ATG exposure post-transplant is excessive. What happens is that ATG that is present post-transplant will inhibit donor T cells and cause slow immune reconstitution that translates into an increased risk of transplant-related mortality. Relapse is the single most important cause of treatment failure. We recognize that there's two types of relapses. Early relapses probably occurs either because the disease is resistant to the conditioning regimen, or as already explained, we are not giving adequate exposure because we're not measuring the drugs that we're giving. However, some tumors have no graft versus tumor effect, and they may just simply outpace the effects of the chemotherapy. Late relapses, those that occur after 1 year, are usually caused by immune evasion mechanisms, tumor hibernation, or the fact that the tumor lives in sanctuary sites. Post-transplant maintenance is now emerging a very common strategy to reduce relapse, particularly for patients with FLT3 mutated AML. This is the result of the SURMAIN study, where the patients who were given sorafenib have a significant lower non-relapse mortality, a significant reduction in the risk of relapse with a hazard ratio of 0.39. Midostaurin was also compared, not in a randomized fashion, but also suggested that the effect in reduction of relapse may be less. It is important to know that many of the studies exploring FLT3 inhibition post-transplant were not done in the context of patients who received FLT3 inhibition prior to transplant. And that's why the BMT-CTN-1506, which is an ongoing phase 3 trial of gilteritinib, is so important. So we need to remember these are older patients. And for many of these patients, becoming frail and losing their independence is as bad as dying. That's why it's important to have an informed discussion with all our elder patients before proceeding to transplants so they understand the risks and benefits. Partly because a patient who becomes frail after transplant has an excess mortality, and this is for patients who become frail, the mortality risk is about 40% at 10 years. There are a lot of geriatric syndromes that happen after allotransplant in older patients. And one of the interesting things is that these patients probably require, again, a multidisciplinary approach post-transplant so they can maintain functional independence and continue to age in a healthy way. However, quality of life and survivorship in older patients seem to be similar to that of younger patients. And we need to remember that these patients have myeloid leukemias, that if they were not transplanted, these patients would have a very limited survival. So in summary, new induction therapies may allow more older patients to proceed to allo-HCT. Allo-HCT remains the most established curative treatment for older patients with acute myeloid leukemia and MDS. Age should no longer be considered a barrier to allogeneic transplant in patients with myeloid leukemias. Careful patient selection and comprehensive geriatric assessment and transplant outcome are essential to optimize outcomes. Continued development and participation in clinical trials will be essential to improve outcomes further. Comparative trials will be essential to determine the best approach for each individual patient. Thank you very much for viewing this activity.